Ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention, please. Welcome back to the next session in our commemoration of the first 40 years of Senate committees. As has been mentioned this morning, two major planks in the establishment of this sequence of committees back in the 1970s. The second plank was the establishment of estimates committees. And the session we have now, throwing light into dark corners, Senate estimates and executive accountability. My name's Cleaver Elliott, and I'm the acting deputy clerk of the Senate, and I'm going to try and keep a very enlivened panel to time this morning. I'd like to introduce again Senator John Hogg, president of the Senate, who will be speaking first, followed by Professor Robert Hill, a former senator of many years' experience, and you can read his illustrious biography in your notes, followed by Robert Ray, a former also illustrious senator with an extensive biography in your notes. And they're going to share their thoughts on our estimates committees and executive accountability. Would you make them welcome, please?
Thanks very much once again. I'm aware of a time constraint that we will break at 11 o'clock, it being Remembrance Day. So I'll try and get through the things that I need to say in that period of time. My view comes from 14 years' experience in this place, and I say that most people in the real world outside know nothing of Senate estimates. Those who know just a modicum about estimates would describe it as people being in a room for the day in the rarefied atmosphere of Parliament House, and the participants there exchange mumbo-jumbo for 11 to 12 hours, and at the end of the day there may be a storyline. To the uninitiated, unwashed, estimates is akin to some secret ritual, with only those immediately involved understanding what is happening. Now, it should not be thus, of course. Estimates provides the opportunity for the people to understand the government of the day's budget and programs, and provides a forum for the government of the day to be held accountable for its actions. Through the estimates process, it brings out and highlights the need for openness and transparency in government. Throwing light into the dark corners, though, is not easy on all occasions. Now, there are a whole lot of rabbit warrens, as my two colleagues may well describe, to go down at estimates. And many of these are not fertile searches indeed as far as the questioner is concerned. That result is generally good for the government and the bureaucracy, but it's not good for the questioner at all. Then every now and again, the questioner finds their quarry, and it is on for young and old alike. But never despair, if this is all you might believe that estimates is about, there's another side. There is assistance to help one through the maze of openness, transparency and accountability of the executive and the departments and agencies of government. This comes in a number of forms and provides the tools of trade for the conduct of estimates. Now, these are not exclusive, of course, but just representative. And I speak of some of the fundamentals of the tools of trade that are used. The portfolio budget statements, of course, the portfolio supplementary estimate statements, the portfolio additional estimate statements. They form the basis. And for those who are aware of them, that's what they look like. Annual reports. Nice weighty document. Ministerial statements, departmental generated material, ANAO reports, media reports, and last but not least, importantly, leaks. The participants are on the one side ministerial departmental agency officials, and on the other, the opposition, minor parties, independents and government backbenchers. Contrary to some perceptions, estimates is not just a process for non-government senators, but a process for everyone to throw light into a dark corner. And I've seen that practically happen in Senate's estimates. The real challenge. Well, the real challenge in estimates, though, is to break down the barriers between the participants. In doing so, one comes to understand what the maybes of this are: what the government is spending its money on, how the department or agencies are handling the spending of that money, and has the government program or programs delivered what it was claimed they would? Now, to achieve this, one must come to grips with a few things. Firstly, the jargon being used. Undoubtedly, it's very central to the organisation that is appearing before you, and it's probably unique. The bureaucratic speak that comes out at estimates, the semantics, and the obfuscation, of course. At the end of the day, though, all one really wants is the plain English version and something that is simple to understand and easy to model. Now, keen students of estimates will know that this is not simply achieved by a single straightforward question and answer, but the truth is accomplished only after long and protracted questioning. So the drip treatment can really work at estimates if you make it do so. Knowledge, though, is the underpinning thing in all of this. To be able to throw the light into the dark corners, one must know one subject. The only way to know this is to read the source documents that I've mentioned, and there are more that I haven't mentioned. In the case of the actual accounts themselves, as contained in the portfolio budget statement and the PAES, this can be challenging. And I can just show you a page of my own very work, and as you will see, it's littered with my own comments, notations, and so on. So it's a matter of understanding what is there in the first instance. One also has to find the thread or the link between all the documents that exist. There has to be a trail that you must be able to follow, money, staffing, or the examination of a specific project. Every now and again, there has been obstacles thrown in the way of seeing the light temporarily, and I call this the translucent period. In the translucent period, there was a change from cash accounting to accrual accounting, which of itself was a long-term initiative and benefit, but in the short term caused great difficulties indeed. Trying to link the dots together, trying to follow the trail, wasn't all that easy. And then there is nothing like the restructuring of the program format or to move to outcomes and outputs to muddy the waters. But of course, we're now past that and there has been a stabilisation to the process which allows for proper review. But in the couple of minutes just left to me, I just want to briefly refer to one of my experiences, which... We've still got a minute to go, I think, so I'll speak for the minute. That's high efficiency. We had this thing called the Defence Efficiency Review, which came about for the 1998-99 budget. And it relied on the PBS and it relied on two reports. Now, here are the two reports that it relied on. These became later known as the Purple Books during the estimates process. And just to show how it has a language all of its own, this became known, surprisingly, as the Little Purple Book, and this became known as the Big Purple Book. And so there was constantly references during the Senate estimates to the Little and the Big Purple books, and also to the PBS itself. So that set about a process all of its own, which after the minute's silence I will describe. lest we forget. That is the most silence I've ever had in one of my addresses. But I think it was the most important silence that we can have. Now, referring to the purple books, the government of the day set about to transfer resources to the pointy end of defence. That's what it was about, essentially. To say the least, this was a major upheaval in defence and the defence community, and so coming to an understanding of it was going to be a painstaking task indeed. There was, of course, jargon. We had to deal with the jargon, and you can imagine that you'd be no sooner talking about what was happening in the PBS than you'd find yourself referred to the little purple book or the big purple book, and you'd have to find which page and so on. But so to navigate it was difficult indeed. Then there was bureaucratic speak, a lot of good little phrases that were chosen there. Semantics, not much obfuscation, but a little bit from at the start. But much to everyone's relief, we, the Royal We of the Senate's Estimates Committee, settled on tracking what was happening within defence using major, and I say this with tongue in cheek, easy to understand matrices. And the matrix actually occupied at least a number of A3 sheets of paper, but at least it put down what was happening in a sensible, we hoped, and logical way. But to get to that point took a great deal indeed in itself. But that was designed to take the mystery out of what was contained there and in the PBS and make it, hopefully, relevant at least to the committee members and the department, so that we were both speaking in the same terms about the same things, but then also to try and make it relevant in the broader public sense. And of course, the design of the two, there were two matrices in effect. One was to follow the money savings in one area of defence and show us where it was transferred in the other. And the second was to follow what was happening to personnel so that we could see personnel being transferred and used properly as well. And the real trick, of course, in all of this was to make the figures follow sequentially from one estimate to the next. In other words, from the estimates to the additional estimates, to the supplementary estimates, to the additional estimates, and then we used to have a supplementary additional estimates at that time. And to have the figures sequentially flow so that there was a logic to it and one could find what was happening was a major challenge indeed. But had that not have happened, then I'm not casting any aspersions on those who were the people who contrived the program, but no one really would have known what was happening and whether the outcomes were being achieved. But in the end, I think we showed that no one really knew what they were doing, because we used to have some enormous arguments about this process, that it looked and sounded good for the defence forces, and that they were still in reasonably good shape in spite of everyone's attempt to go down this path, was a major commendation to our defence forces and their resilience, because even our people, whether they be on the government side, the bureaucrats or the senators at estimates, could not dent the resilience of our defence forces in any way. But it certainly added to the thrills and spills of life. But I do not think what happened on this occasion did make those driving the process stop and think. I do think, I should say, it made them stop and think. And that was the important thing. Without this, there would have been no transparency, really, in the process, because people would have just had to accept it at face value, not really understanding what was taking place. And the fact then that at least a number of us could get down to some understanding of what was taking place was indeed important indeed. And it did cause some real light to be thrown into the whole process of the Defence Efficiency Review, and it did cause people to question some of the things that the Executive of Government and that the Department of Defence of the day were doing. And of course, I think, added to the transparency, openness and accountability of government. I'll stop there. I think I've given you an example, and I've got plenty more if you need them.
Professor Robert Hill.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to contribute, to participate in today's discussions, and gives me an opportunity to reflect on some experiences of the past and a rare opportunity to make a few comments that hopefully might be useful in contemplating the Senate of the future. Sitting here with Cleaver brings back lots of memories, and looking at him and looking at Rosemary and the other staff of the Senate reminds me of the dedication and commitment of the officers of the Senate that in many ways have perhaps contributed to its high standing in the eyes of the Australian community beyond the performance of the elected representatives. So thank you, and thank you for your continued commitment to the institution. Good to be here with the President of the Senate to question me for hours in estimates on defence matters, always on the issues, which was not necessarily the case for all his colleagues. And also good to be here with former Senator Ray. We came in here at the same time and had the same experiences, but from the opposite sides of the chamber. And comparing his views and mine might be, in fact, interesting. And for other former colleagues in the room, it's good to catch up with them as well. I started off by saying how important the institution is and how commendable it is that the clerks do their best to maintain its standing in the eyes of the community. Politicians who enter the Senate obviously think that the institution is important also, but their focus is on the politics. And I think that's not always widely understood. And if it is understood, people say, well, there's something wrong with that because there should be some other motive. But you enter politics because you have a view of government and governance and ideas on how you'd like to see governance work better in Australia, and you then seek to find a seat to implement that through the political process. And you might choose to stand for the Senate or the House of Representatives, in the case of the Commonwealth, for a range of different reasons. One might be that you don't think you'll be able to win a seat in the House of Representatives. Other reasons might be that you think you've got a better chance of getting in on a list, and therefore stand for the Senate. Others might be that you're an independent or a member of a small party and the proportional representation system would give you a better chance in the Senate. There'd be a range of reasons. But some do actually favour the Senate because they think it fits their particular skill sets and that they might be able to actually contribute more effectively through the Senate and its mechanisms. So those mechanisms are distinguishable from the House of Representatives, and it is, apart from the structure and the et cetera, it is largely through the committee system and the consideration of matters of detail. And matters of detail are important if you're interested in the issues of government and more effective government. Now, that, of course, was not the reason that the Senate was set up, but when it became apparent at very early times that the real objective of representing the states would be somewhat overwhelmed by the political reality of the strength of the parties and the discipline within the parties, it seems that there were some who were wise enough to believe that if the Senate was to play a worthwhile role in that new environment, then it did need to be distinguishable in some ways from the House of Representatives. And I think it was they that started this process of building the Senate committee systems, of which the estimates are a very important part. And I've looked at most parliaments around the world have some form of estimates committee, and which includes the state parliaments in Australia, and even our House of Representatives sort of flirts with it from time to time. But there are very few parliamentary institutions in the world that have actually taken the concept and issues of financial scrutiny through an estimates committee quite as far as the Australian Senate. But it is important, I think, to recognise that the estimates committee process is just part of a broader process of scrutiny. And the opportunity for at least some level of public involvement in that scrutiny at some depth, and I think you're looking at the other Senate committees today also in that light. So scrutiny, yes, there is a mass of financial material that senators have available to them to assist them in that financial scrutiny. I have to say that I think some senators have never read one of those books in the whole of their parliamentary careers. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're less effective in estimates, because if you come back to my overriding thesis that for a politician it's all about politics, when you go into an estimates committee, you may be interested in the structure of the budget, but there are generally some political issues on your mind, and the form of estimates gives you, and the fact that there is always a financial aspect to those political issues gives you the opportunity to question that is rarely given elsewhere, which is the point that I'm seeking to make, that you as a parliamentarian, as a politician, have the opportunity to question a minister and or senior officials on your particular issue, which you dress up in terms of a particular budget issue, at some length, sometimes too much length, and in some depth. And that is an opportunity, as I said, that is rarely available anywhere else. Now, how effective is it in terms of scrutiny? And is a debatable thing, the extent to which the public gain any greater knowledge or benefit from it is a debatable thing. Basically, the public will generally only learn from the estimates committee what one or two journalists think that is worth reporting, and that tends to be the titillating bit about the Paul Keating's dog kennel at the lodge, or the extent to which Mrs. Howard influenced the paintwork in Kirribilli. Robert Ray, I think, questioning about the wine cellar at that was John Faulkner.
A Rachabite.
I had to cop both Robert Ray and John Faulkner for 10 years as a tag team in these things. But in actual fact, they were probably not the matters that, in terms of light in the corner, that were of greater importance. From a minister's perspective, when I was environment minister, I guess the issues that I were questioned upon, which were probably most important from a public perspective, were really the processes by which I determined grants of public money, and I was responsible for some very large grant programs. The Natural Heritage Trust was $1 billion. The Federation Fund was a lot of money. And therein was an opportunity, and a very legitimate opportunity, for me to be questioned in some depth on how decisions were reached. And Cleaver, who has always been helpful from the first day I met him, said that this was set up as a whiteboard just to remind me of experiences about ministerial accountability and what might be taken from a committee, whether it's an estimates or a select committee or whatever, in terms of ministerial accountability that could have grave consequences. And when I think back of my time of having to answer questions as opposed to having to ask the questions, that was, something that was important to the public in terms of transparency, but the public may never have really known the detail. And in terms of being defence minister, again, there was lots of serious discussion about wars and the like. But probably the most important issues in terms of the estimates process itself was really in the procurement budget, which is a very big budget, complex budget, as Robert and I both know. And there's lots of different interests playing roles in how decisions are made in relation to the acquisition of defence material, and there's no other opportunity within our parliamentary system to really question in depth on those issues, the literally billions of dollars that are spent every year, and how the decisions are made, and what is the role of the parliamentarian or lobbyist or anybody else within that process. And and I think that that was probably the most important. So I think of what did the public read. There wasn't so much it was titillating in defence, but I think over my period, although I came in after the event, the child overboard affair probably got the greatest coverage because of the drama, but also the interesting issues of lines of communication between defence personnel, military on the one hand, and then the civilians, and then how that message passes through to the political masters who have an ultimate decision-making role, and then how that is communicated to the public and the consequences for getting it wrong. And then in defence, of course, when mistake is recognised, how it then all happens again in terms of who tells somebody what and the level of public accountability through that process. And the other one that I remember, because it was all in my time, were the events in Abu Ghraib, the notorious prison in Iraq, and what role Australian military personnel or non-military had in relation to the operational decisions in those prisons. And in many ways the same issue, very embarrassing for me, because the defence establishment informed me that Australians had no knowledge of these events. And then I told the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister told the Parliament, to the House of Representatives, and told the public. And then a certain military officer said actually he did bring back documents from Iraq, but he decided he wouldn't own up to that, and he then changed his mind, told the hierarchy passed it up again. I go in and see the Prime Minister in the morning and say, Prime Minister, I have a little problem I want to discuss with you. And then that's at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then at 9 o'clock in the morning I'm before defence estimates. with Faulkner and Ray, and that was quite a hard day at the office, actually. So it wasn't, there was a financial aspect to it, and but it wasn't the key aspect, but it was a legitimate way of getting into the debate, particularly under the liberal interpretation that the clerks give to estimates. See the smiles in the front row. This business favours oppositions, the Senate. Senate is all about oppositions. It's never good to be in politics and to be in opposition, but if you have to be, and I had 14 years of it, it's better to be in the Senate than in the House of Representatives, because at least you have the opportunity to do the sort of things that Ray and Faulkner did to me, and feel that you didn't have a bad day. But so what I'm really saying is that there's an element of transparency. It mightn't have been part of the original design. It's been part of an evolution of process. And it is useful, even if it is not, we might think, hasn't yet got to the stage where the focus is on the matters that are of most importance, or that we've got to a way in which those matters that are of most importance are properly developed and made more transparent through the Senate process, and then most importantly a way in which that can be effectively communicated to the broader public, which hopefully then influences the health of our parliamentary process and our democracy. So I'll leave it at that point. Look forward to your questions.
The next speaker on the panel is former Senator Robert Ray.
Well, thank you. You know, somewhere, someplace in Canberra right now, public servants are making an administrative or a policy decision, and one of the key questions they're going to ask, will this survive scrutiny at estimates? This happens day in, day out in Canberra for the last 25 years. What higher testament can a set of Senate committees have than it's in the minds of every public servant? And I'm sure often when administrative decisions are made in a minister's office, Senator Hill's office or mine, we wondered, will we be able to survive a cross-examination on this? Will we be able to justify it? How many billions of dollars do you think have been saved simply by having the threat of Senate estimates committees? I mean, you bring overseas visitors in to watch an estimates committee. I mean, parliamentarians from overseas, they're gobsmacked. They've never seen anything like it, not even the Americans, with their strengthened congressional system. Time and time again, in state upper houses, they've tried to replicate the Senate estimates system with very limited success. On two occasions, estimates have been set up in the House of Representatives, but only to wither on the vine through indifference. So who designed this great scrutiny process? Well, I have to tell you, it's more a case of evolution than creationism. I mean, it evolved basically in the 70s, rolling into the 80s, right through till today. It evolved and gathered pace and effectiveness as it went. I mean, every time a senator pushed the boundary out, may not go that far out, but it never came back to where it was before. And so you do have this immensely effective scrutiny. It's been nurtured by Senate staff. It's been exploited by oppositions. And it's been reluctantly endorsed by government. Most ministers find the process either draining or infuriating. But the prospect of trying to fight it out, they eventually give in. They eventually answer the questions. They sit till 6 o'clock in the morning, like my colleague here did one day, never again, I noticed, just to try to break the committee. They do all those things, but in the end, they give in. And of course, it's underpinned by standing orders, but it really relies on accrued conventions. Unless you have conventions in politics and in the Senate chamber and in these committees, they don't work. And if people basically abide by these conventions, you get a very effective system. I mean, it's totally sustained by history and traditions, but it's also underpinned by a lack of a government majority in the Senate. These estimates committees would not have evolved if there was a government majority in the Senate. Sure, there was for two or three years, but the traditions, the conventions, overwhelmed that government majority in the end. And people saw the light. People, the Senate leaders and others, saw the light and said, no, we can't cut off this process. And on it went. I mean, all sides are exasperated by the Senate Estimates Committee. Senate Hill said they're for oppositions. Dead right. They are for oppositions, etc. But that's just part of the balance between executive and parliament. It's counterbalanced in other areas. And of course governments get frustrated by the estimates process. You know, when some senator starts asking questions about what happened to the chickens at the lodge when government transitioned from Rudd to Gillard, it does actually demean the thing. But of course, a lot of this is political payback. Senator Hill probably got annoyed when we asked questions about all this, but he recalls me being asked questions about the dog kennel at the lodge. So naturally, 1996, we get into political payback. We do the same thing. And we would have desisted after 2 years, except the feedback we got was the occupants of the lodge hated us for it. And how could we give it up then, when we're creating so much joy for ourselves and so much hatred elsewhere? Of course, governments get frustrated by the time, and this is, you know, 9 in the morning till 11 at night is a long time to go through a committee process, over 4 days often. It is resource intensive. It occupies time of public servants in preparation, attending the committee, and then following up for questions taken on notice. But you just compare the estimates process with question time in Parliament, which is really about government, not about oppositions. Government get half the questions, so they know the answers in advance. The other half, they avoid answering anyway and spend half their time slagging off the person that asked the question. So it is not a balanced system. Fortunately, in the Senate, we have supplementary questions, a noting of questions, which balances up between the executive and the opposition far more than the House of Representatives. I'll just go through a couple of simple facts about estimates. I mean, there are 8 estimates committees. They meet 4 at a time. They meet 3 times a year. There's always, or nearly always, a minister or a parliamentary secretary in attendance. And what they should be is adversarial to the minister and inquisitorial to the public servant. That is the golden rule of estimates committee, with one exception. If a public servant is dissembling, if you know the public servant is deliberately misleading or distorting the truth, you can then move over to adversarial. But as a general rule, it should just be inquisitorial. There are a number of truth avoidance mechanisms embedded in our estimate system. First one, of course, is taking a question on notice. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator, I don't have that information available to me. I mean, that becomes a bit red hot when I've got the leaked advisory note that they're going off and all the details are there. Which didn't happen too often, and therefore you press in those instances. But often, questions are taken on notice that could be answered on the spot. They're taken on notice to prevent follow-up questions. The second excuse is that's a commercial in confidence matter, and quite often it is, and therefore it is areas that the Senate estimates can't transgress in. But when you ask for a document where only 2 lines are commercial in confidence and the other 10 pages aren't, you should be provided with that document with the commercial in confidence area blocked out. The third area of avoidance is advice to ministers. And the Estimates Committee gradually are getting more into this area. And it is a tough one. We don't actually want to inhibit public servants giving frank and earnest advice to their ministers on the basis, before a decision is made, on the basis that that will have to be exposed at Estimates Committee. I just urge all current day senators to treat that with some sort of balance. Of course, you have cabinet inconfidence, which in my view is inviolate, unless a government starts creating every document it can and calling it cabinet inconfidence. That's not on. But for a genuine cabinet document, it should be protected from scrutiny at an estimates committee. Then there's national security. A lot of areas, I can't remember ASIS being cross-examined at an estimates committee. The Joint Intelligence Committee does that. Not necessary. And finally, of course, you're blocked off for asking questions if there's a judicial inquiry. Oops, the government's a bit embarrassed paying $300 million worth of bribes to Saddam Hussein. we'll set up a judicial inquiry and we'll answer no questions at all, either at question time or in the Senate estimates. And when you get round to it at Senate estimates, after Coles put in his weak report, 18 months later, it's too late. So basically, there are quite a few mechanisms that stop exploration at estimates. Now, the organiser of the conference said, can you give us a few examples of estimates issues? So I might give you an example of a success, a nil-all result and a failure. The first one was 1998, at the height of the GST issue, the government decided to direct mail every Australian elector with their proposition on GST. Now, it's to be direct mailed rather than household delivery, because we all know it's a far more effective political way of getting your message over. And they were to use the Electoral Act. And that all came out at an estimates committee just up the road, a couple of doors up the road. And it was one of the more acrimonious estimates committee I've ever attended, and I have to say, it's the only time, my entire time at estimates, that I lost my temper, as opposed to feigning losing my temper. And I had a massive clash with the Electoral Commissioner, who threw the Electoral Act at me and demanded I point out to him where he was wrong and I was right. I try to point out that I was one of the authors of the Electoral Act at the time, of the 83 changes, but to no avail. And from there we took our battle to the Attorney-General's Department. The Senior Council of Attorney-Generals ruled against us. The Electoral Commission, the Taxation Office all said we were wrong. So we went to the Federal Court, or we prepared to go to the Federal Court. We hired an SC. The Electoral Commission got to him 10 minutes after us. And he said to them, I'm otherwise engaged in this case, which really rocked them. And so eventually it went to the Solicitor General, who wrote a one-page opinion saying this is an illegal act. You cannot proceed with it. This would have been an illegal act committed 9 million times, and the Estimates Committee process prevented it happening. The fact that the letters were pulped was expensive. The fact that I was left with the legal fees would have been very expensive, except the SC and the solicitor said, great victory, we'll just write that on our CV, no charge. So that was good. So that was one aspect that I'd say was successful. Let me give you the nil-all draw, and it's going quite a way back into history, back to 1996. There was a lot of 1997, sorry. There was controversy over Senator Mel Colson at the time, and certain newspaper articles alluded to maybe some faults he had. The Prime Minister of the day demanded that Kim Beazley, as leader of the opposition, give permission to release documents from the previous government. He had no choice. I mean, he was right over a barrel, and he did so. And so those documents went from the Attorney-General's department to the Attorney-General, who read them all and signed them off. They then went round to the Prime Minister's office, and then they went to Kim Beazley and were released for publication. A few days later, Prime Minister Howard accused Kim Beazley and Gareth Evans of being perverters of the course of justice, on the basis that their failure to prosecute Mel Colston back in 1983 had no support from either the department or anyone else. And didn't look too good for us at that stage. But what turned out, of course, is that the two key documents, the one where the Solicitor General agrees with the two ministers, the one where the department secretary signs off advice to act that way, they disappeared in the Prime Minister's office. They never appeared until about 10 months later, when the Prime Minister's department fessed up and passed them on. Well, that did get pursued at estimates, never finalised, and I described that as a nil-all draw. The last one, the biggest failure in my time at estimates, has some resonance today because it concerns the new member for Denison, Andrew Wilkie. I don't know how many of you remember, he left ONA probably about 2003, 2004, giving the government a great spray on the way out the door. A couple of weeks later, an article appeared in the Melbourne Herald Sun, quoting, and accurately, an article or a submission from Andrew Wilkie done for ONA on Iraq that then showed that whatever spray he gave on the way out the door, here were his real opinions. Well, that's a pretty good get. Problem is, The document quoted from was top secret, code-worded and austere, one of the highest rankings you can get. How did that get to a Melbourne journalist, and actually, I'm sorry to say, I hope you don't take offence, Senator Hill, a lickspittle of the Liberal Party, basically, in the Melbourne Sun? How did it get there? Well, you try to establish that through the estimates process, and you're constantly told, you're dealing with national security issues, we can't help you there, we put it in the hands of the police, and this went on for years. So we never got to properly explore how a top-secret, osteo code-worded document had got to one of the favoured sons of the government of the day to write in print. Now, the Federal Police, of course, put out a very constrained statement at the end of the investigation saying they had insufficient evidence to proceed with a prosecution. In other words, they did know who leaked it. I know who leaked it now. But we could never, ever pursue that properly at estimates because it was a national security issue. I'm not criticising the government of the day for so categorising it, but I think it's a pity that there is a traitor walking around today that leaked this document and we weren't able to pursue it. I was also asked, and I'll just finish on this note, I think, how do you prepare for estimates, I was asked. Well, gee, I've got to tell the truth here. I used to meet with John Faulkner on a Sunday night in my office, we'd have dinner, and we'd spend about an hour discussing what was going to come up for the next 2 weeks. If the cricket was on, well, we'd reduce that back by at least half an hour. So somehow we had to perpetuate the myth that we spent every living, breathing minute of our life researching and pursuing ministers. The truth is otherwise. You use as your source material previous estimates, hearings and committee questions taken on notice. Every time there's a newspaper clipping referring to some area of your interest, just throw it in the estimates box. Forget about it. And on the Sunday night, you dig it out and start writing some notes. Annual reports, very valuable, especially at additional estimates, because you can ask any question on annual reports. Doesn't have to be an additional estimates item. Sources, of course, every now and then, you get a whistleblower that's unhappy or some other malevolent leaker, and you use their material. But you always follow the principle, never trust a rat. So never assert what they've told you is true. Say you've been advised, but never take it as absolute truth. And the other thing is, just do it on instinct. You know, you'd be there at estimates committee and you'd be asking 10 questions in a row. Suddenly some public servant would smile. You think, no, this is the one to go on. So you'd drop the rest and just pursue that one. There were techniques that you had to use. You'd get a taciturn witness. I can remember a person I admire, but a former head of the ONA, who'd never really tell you anything. So what you'd do is start asking him easy questions. And he'd start hitting sixes and fours all over the place. Then you'd gradually start bringing the ball back on a off stump. And by the end of the day, you couldn't stop him talking about sensitive material. So technique was always important. You need luck too. I asked one question simply because in looking at Mel Colston's travel records, I saw him opening a conference in the Gold Coast and claiming travel allowance in Canberra. I just threw a spear at that, you know, just asked the question. The panic that then ensued was immense. Three ministers lost their job. Both the government and opposition were massively embarrassed. A department was abolished. A deputy president was replaced. Oh, well, you could go on. And we all got smeared. Even the honest ones amongst us, Senator Hill and I and everyone else, we all got covered in a bucket. From one spear thrown on one day as an offhand comment led to that. So you need luck, and I don't know whether it was luck or bad luck. And, of course, finally, you need reputation. If you've got a reputation for being a ruthless cross-examiner and a merciless team, well, it carries you through. I can remember on one classic occasion, finishing probably with Senator Hill. He wanted to leave a fraction early, and we thought, that's good. And we wheeled out of Senate Room 1 on the floor there. And I said to John, oh, the estimates is going next door. Let's pop in and ask Kerry O'Brien what he wants from Porsches, because he was joining us for dinner. And so we march in with our folders and we thump down on the table. The minister gagged. Two deputy secretaries ran in the room and everyone's waiting for the assault. and I'm getting an order for Shantung Lamb. And then we got up and left and confused everyone. So reputation does help. I want to finish on this last point. And it's been hinted at by John Ewer and others. This Senate committee system is gold and needs to be preserved. But the biggest danger is trying to expand it too much. Within 5 months of the Rudd government, we had 7 select committees established in the Senate, which I regard as a disgrace. We as an opposition under the Howard government kept select committees to 2 throughout the life of the 11-12 years. To then suddenly expand them puts pressure on senators. They can't read all the material. They can't attend all the meetings. The secretariat itself, in the end, can't write the reports and have to get consultants in. You can't delegate it out that far. We've got enough committees already to cover the workload. No more than 2 select committees. You don't just continue set up committee after committee. You will just destroy the system itself. I want to end on this one anecdote about the effectiveness of the Senate. So a few years ago, a House of Reps member ran to my office, so excited he was. He says, "Guess what? The Reserve Bank Governor is going to attend the House of Representatives Economics Committee twice a year. See how important we are." I just said to him, "Look, he just regards you as a bunch of Uncle Toms. He can avoid Senate scrutiny this way. Piss off." So, thank you.
All right, well, it's come to that time where we can take questions or comments. Are there any questions or comments in relation to this segment of the panel's discussions?
There are an awe of you.
There's a hard question too.
Yes.
Ross, thank you very much. It's been very interesting to see what you've done in Australia. Now, my biggest frustration is the fact the annual reports are never ready for our October estimates. So that's something I'd just like to put on the record. It's very, very annoying that they come down and follow the list, and it makes it very hard for us.
Comment?
Yeah, sure. Look, it's quite often because the reports aren't certified in time by the Auditor General. I mean, it's such a tight process. And it does mean that in a technical sense, you can't use it. But from an estimate sense, additional estimates are always in February. And this is where annual reports are to be used. I mean, used both for real reasons or the excuse to get into a policy area that there's no additional appropriation for. So in the end, it does work. I know how it's frustrating to other people. I'm on an organisation in Melbourne, and they've been absolutely churning over getting their annual report accurate and out of time. And I sort of said to them, "Only 10 people ever read it. What are you worried about?"
Any other questions, comments? You're going to let them off that easily. Now, here we have another question.
You've made a comment about the House of Representatives and the role of committees. Under the arrangements for a new parliament, a better parliament, there's a lot of discussion about what the House of Representatives might do in terms of greater scrutiny. Do you have, all of you, any comments about potential roles?
Oh, I think they'd do better to just leave it to the Senate. But I'll, one of the tricks of the business is you get asked a question and you answer another one. And I was sitting here thinking, when Robert Ray was speaking, about the mysteries of the estimates process. And I had this experience once when I was a very young senator, and the minister was late John Button. And he was industry minister, was in the old Parliament House, and he was industry minister at the time. He was in government, I was in opposition, and I was at the Estimates Committee. And things were going slow, and I got this note passed down to me from the minister, John Button, saying, "Ask him about this. This is, ask his official about this." I never worked out whether Button was trying to give me some practice or whether he'd been trying to get the answer out of the official and been unsuccessful.
I might as well tell my John Button story. Now, we used to, in government, some of us, being backbenchers, play tennis at lunchtime, take a late shower, have a bite to lunch and get to question time halfway through. And in those days, the Senate President, you'll be pleased to know, Senator Hogg, wasn't given a list of the questioners. I mean, it came up with who was due. And on one occasion, it was about 8 minutes to two, Senator Button's staff arrived at the tennis courts and said, "Senator Button wants a question asked, and you're first up." So I had 8 minutes, no lunch of course, to shower, change. I race down to the chamber, I read this question out, and Senator Button turns around and says, "Well, thank you, Senator Ray, for that Dorothy Dixar." He then proceeded to give a very erudite answer, sat down smugly, but then heard the horrible words he never expected. "Supplementary question, Mr. President," which he had no idea about whatsoever.
I thought you were going to say that Button answered by saying, "That's a silly question."
The panel spoke of the nature of the conventions, similar to constitutional conventions, and how they are guiding the practice of the Senate committees. Are they recorded anywhere, or are they in the bosom of the clerk of the Senate?
Well, to an extent they're recorded in the Senate Bible lodges. Not every one of them, but to an extent. But most of them aren't recorded. Most of them are just exceeded. Yes, we'll do that. You know, from time to time, a Senate Estimates Committee will say, "We're only allocating 1 hour for the Weather Bureau." Well, you get to the end of the hour and you've still got questions. Guess what? You keep going. It's just a guide. But everyone knows it's just a guide. And so most of these things are accepted. There have been time to time where people have decided to defy Estimates Committee. We had one classic case, not a minister, but a witness to do with information technology, that from 4:30 till 6:30 defied a Senate committee to answer any questions. And the Labor senators concerned rang me and John Faulkner and said, "Can you come down at 7:30? Anyway, we came down and, by 8:30, having gone over the top with Bainetts, we had this person talking. And 3 weeks later, he quit and went back to Canada. There's an example. Now, that should not have been allowed. Shouldn't have been allowed by the chair of the committee or the minister to occur. That a witness just sits there and says they're not going to answer questions. Simply not part of the process. The conventions don't allow it, and they should be overridden.
We have a question.
Yeah, I don't. It's not a convention, but just following on, if you do believe in the system, you should believe that it should work as effectively as possible. And one example was when I was a minister, I always insisted that the departmental secretary attend. Most departmental secretaries don't like it. And sometimes those that had ministers from the House of Representatives, got the wink and the nod not to attend. And I think that leads to a less effective system. So you can't make them. Well, technically you might be able to, but in practice you can't. So you do need a certain amount of goodwill to make it work effectively. But as I sort of said, there are conventions, but I've always found that the clerks interpreted them in favour of the opposition.
Yes. Could I just add that this is where we differ? I never, ever wanted my secretary of my department at the Estimates Committee initially. I said, "Leave it to the others, and when they totally stuff up, we can bring you along to pull us out." And then Tony Ayres once asked me, "What happens when I stuff up?" I said, "I'll bring the new secretary along."
We have a question upstairs. Question upstairs.
Thank you. My question was, what do you see as the advantages or disadvantages of the Senate inviting ministers from the lower house to appear at Estimates?
The only person I've ever known who was really keen, who watched every minute of defence estimates, every second of it, who'd love to have been there himself, was Kim Beazley. Therefore, I think that proves my case that we shouldn't have them. There is a thing called the comity of between the two chambers, and it's virtually never been breached by these committees. I mean, it has two aspects. Do they have the power to call ministers from another chamber? Yes, we do, if the House of Representatives agrees to release them to come. And I'm afraid, not even afraid, I'm pleased to say that's never going to happen. Because it leads to a circus. It's all very well for the Senate, with a non-government majority, to demand that the Prime Minister and the Treasurer turns up. What'll happen next? Well, the House of Reps will set up a committee and start demanding that the Leader of the Opposition and others attend. And so you'll get payback-style politics from misuse and abuse of committees from both chambers. And the same applies to the calling of staff. I'd have loved on occasions to cross-examine ministerial staff. And I mean, that lunatic asylum in Victoria, the Legislative Council, is constantly demanding that staff attend. You don't think a Liberal government anywhere else in Australia is going to condone that? I'm sure Senator Hill wouldn't have condoned Liberal ministerial staff turning up to committees. So whilst it sounds good, I really don't think it's good for the comity between the two chambers to be able to call witnesses from one to the other, with one exception, and especially not estimates. But, I mean, if there's a committee of inquiry and an invitation goes to a House of Reps minister and they say, I want to attend, well, fine. That's good.
I basically agree with that. We went through the political process of demanding on some occasions ministers from the other House appear before committees, but we were never really upset when they refused to do so, because we knew that it would lead to undermining the workability between the two chambers.
Do we have a supplementary question up there? No. Another?
Wayne Tunnicliffe, Clerk of the Legislative Council in Victoria.
I did see you there. I was looking at you.
I was actually going to save my question on ministerial advisers to the session on parliamentary privilege this afternoon, so I'll be back. I will do that. I know you are. My question now, though, concerns cabinet documents. We keep hearing from the government quite often that a reason to not provide a document in response to the council's order to do so is that the document is either a cabinet document, commercial in confidence, or offends against the confidentiality provisions of various acts. But my question about cabinet documents is that it seems to me that more and more documents are being brought by government within the ambit of a cabinet document. Nobody has ever had a real go at defining it, except perhaps Justice Spiegelman in the Egan versus Chadwick case in New South Wales. So I was going to ask both Mr. Ray and Professor Hill what your views are as to what is a proper cabinet document that therefore justifies not being provided to either a House of Parliament or its committees.
Well, could I say, I think it's a document that's used in support of cabinet submissions or decisions before cabinet. And I did warn in my address, the extension beyond that to protect all documents is a very bad thing. And in the end, it'll bring down that protection. See, every time you abuse one of these things and extend the definition out, the closer you are to bringing it down one day. And but in many cases, you know, I've seen documents. Where do you draw the line and say, well, this cabinet document can be released and this one can't? Very, very difficult. You can say, well, commercial in confidence, national security, all these others. But it will affect advice and then advice from public servants to ministers if they think it has to be accountable publicly. But it has to be a narrow definition. And how do you define that? Do you put it in legislation? Or again, do you have a decently recognised convention and behavioural pattern?
I can't answer your question on that.
Yeah, I think the test is, will it unreasonably undermine the effectiveness of government if a document is going to be put forward and it would mean that an official wouldn't again give you that advice, then there's a pretty strong argument for it not to be made public. And I didn't have many problems in this area, because basically if you're the minister, you're being questioned on the decisions that you make, and you're supposed to be able to answer those questions. So I didn't have to hide behind cabinet in confidence documents. But I'd have to say, if we're allowed to have a bit of a go at the bureaucracy, some parts of our bureaucracy have a habit, almost a convention, to grossly overclassify documents. DFAT is appalling. You know, DFAT officials slam in confidence or secret or restricted or on everything, so that they can not have to justify the contents. And 99% of it, there's no reason why it justified that classification. But mind you, it's not just Australia's foreign service. All foreign services do it. So maybe politicians are more comfortable with public scrutiny, parliamentary scrutiny. They just accept that as part of life, and others are less comfortable. But and within the estimates, that is an important role of the minister of the day in relation to his or her public servants too. There is an element of needing to protect them in their role, and where you draw the line. And beyond that, although it's probably not said as often, is that the committee itself is aware of the conventions also, and generally speaking will respect the interests of the public servant, provided, as Robert Ray said, the public servant isn't him or herself abusing that privilege.
Would you like to thank the panel for an excellent presentation?
More than defence.
I think it does too, yeah. And of course they hate scrutiny, defence and duty.
Was it lunch?
I'm Roxanne Le Guin, and until very recently it was my privilege to serve committees every day. We have to speak about Senate committees and legislation to distinguish panel members in Ms. Sue Knowles and Ms. Vicky Bourne. They both have served on committees for many years. Sue Knowles has been a senator, or was a senator, for more than 20 years, and during that time she was the chair of the Senate Community Affairs Legislation Committee. She also served as deputy chair of that committee on many inquiries. As deputy opposition whip in the Senate, she served, of course, on the Selection of Bills Committee, and she has a good understanding of how bills go to committees. And she'll be able also to talk to you about the effect of the inquiries on the debate in the chamber. Vicky Bourne has worked on both sides of the Senate process, both as a research officer to Senator Colin Mason and Senator Paul MacLean before entering the Senate herself. She's served on many committees. She was always an active participant on many committees, and she also was the Australian Democrats whip on and therefore served on the selection of Bills Committee. Likewise, she'll be able to tell you about the process afterwards. So if you would welcome Sue Knowles in the first instance.
Thank you, Roxanne, for your very kind words and also for the invitation to be here today. It's an interesting process when we sit here and as former senators listening about Senate committees. As someone who, as Roxanne said, served almost 21 years in the Senate, I was a stickler for the Senate committee process and a bit of a traditionalist, I have to say. I didn't like to see some of the changes that were being made that I believed were negatively impacting upon the Senate process. But one of the processes that was made in the late 80s, early 90s, was the referral of bills to committee. And part of that reason was to overcome the logjam that was happening within the Senate chamber in the committee of the whole process. And if anyone has sat through the debate and some of the controversial bills in the Senate chamber through the committee of the whole, you would know what I mean when I talk about soaring sawdust, because it can be a very long and exhaustive process that just goes around and around and around in circles. So the reference of bills to committee was to take the more controversial bills and the parts thereof and look at them at the committee stage in a committee, and to look at the possibility of the types of amendments that could usefully be used back into the Senate chamber and the committee of the whole. As part of that process, back in days gone by, back in the old Parliament House and even when we moved up here, Friday was a sitting day for the Senate. And so it was decided to sacrifice Friday and make it a committee day for the reference of bills to committee. And that worked exceptionally well for a period of time because senators understood and ministers understood that that was in lieu of a sitting day and therefore the committee process could take place, and it was usefully then put to the community whereby those who were affected by various pieces of legislation would be called upon as witnesses, the departmental people could be called as witnesses, and therefore the committee had an opportunity to do that examination that would otherwise be done in the Senate. The senators would then draft potential amendments and then they would be taken to the chamber. So it saved a considerable amount of time. And during that process, I think everyone agreed that it was a terrific idea and worked exceptionally well. Over the period of time, as the change in senators became more rapid in the Senate, because when I came in here, you know, all us old fossils, or the new ones, were with the old fossils, and then I became an old fossil, and the change was minimal. But during the early 90s and beyond, it was like a revolving door. And so the concept of this having a Friday as a committee day at the end of a sitting was just as though you'd asked someone to pull all their teeth out. And so they said, no, I have more pressing engagements. Ministers had more pressing engagements, and the system slowly but surely started to fall apart. It also started to fall apart because they became full-blooded inquiries on the bill, not just necessarily the controversial sections of the bill, but the broader bill content itself. It then became a process whereby we would not just have the hearings in Canberra on a Friday of a sitting week, we will trot all around Australia. And we will get submissions from every Tom, Dick and Harry, wherever we go, and they started to draw out further and further and further. And so the whole thing really degenerated into somewhat of a farce. There were no draft amendments put together. It all came back to the chamber, and the committee of the whole in the chamber then became as long and as exhaustive as it ever was. So what really needs to happen, I think, basically, is it's a good idea, but there needs to be goodwill on all sides. There needs to be a will and goodwill on all sides for it to work. And I don't just say oppositions and governments, because now with more independents or minor parties, they all want to have their say. They're all very committed to various other committees, and it needs to be a formalised arrangement whereby, if this is to ever happen again, it needs to be a formalised arrangement whereby people know that that is the day for that inquiry. It's not a long, drawn-out inquiry, but it is a given time by which people can make submissions, attend an inquiry, and the committee report back to the Senate. Because, as has been said previously, the demand now on the secretariats of the committees is enormous, absolutely enormous. When they have parallel inquiries going on, there is only so much the committee secretariats can do. And they are wonderful, dedicated people who want to make sure that it's right. And to make sure that this system works well, probably needs to have a rethink as to the time frame that would be required to make it work. For example, I would suggest that if this was to ever come about again, that it wouldn't be a referral of the bill to a committee on a Tuesday or Wednesday, I think, Vicky, wasn't it, for an inquiry on a Friday. Therefore, you'd get not only the senators in a flap, you'd get the committee secretariat in a flap, you would have witnesses in a flap, because suddenly the various interested witnesses get a call from the secretariat, do you want to attend to put your case on X, Y and Z part of the legislation this coming Friday? Well, you can imagine what that would do to various people's diaries. So maybe if it was to work again, we would need a longer lead-in time to ensure that people did have time to consider thoughtfully the process, and I mean that from all parties concerned. Because sometimes even the senators were not across the legislation. It might be their minister or shadow minister, and their relevant staff or the members of their own, say, backbench committee, who would know the detail of the legislation. It would give a longer lead time, would give the party rooms a different time frame in which to consider those controversial elements of the legislation. It would also give them time to consider the viability and practicality of various amendments that might make the legislation better. And I focus on that part of making the legislation better, because invariably with the original system, it did in fact improve the legislation. And ultimately, ministers or governments and opposition alike would say, well, the upshot of the process has made the legislation and its intent better. So if the process is to be reintroduced, then maybe that lead-in time gives that opportunity to have more thoughtful consideration from all parties, including those who wish to make submissions. Because it's important, I think, from this day and age to ensure that the community is involved and as much as possible in the legislative process. And people do appreciate being asked to attend committee hearings, and they do appreciate their views being heard. So while one might not agree with all their views, it is nonetheless important to hear them and to consider them, because they do invariably raise things that have not been considered before and also raise unintended consequences of a piece of legislation. So I do think it's a very, very good process. It is an initiative, I think, that has worked well in the past. While it fell down, there needs to be an education process that makes sure that the party leaders, the various party leaders, inform the members of committees that this is a process that needs to be adhered to. It is a process that needs to be treated very seriously, and it is a process that can work very, very effectively. But I think when this started to fall apart, there was that generational change and turnover of senators, and there was no sort of formal instruction, if you want to put it that way, that new senators were getting, that this was a part of their commitment to the Senate in lieu of sitting in the Senate on that given Friday. So senators who are genuinely interested, I think, also in the legislation can have an opportunity to attend such inquiries and such hearings, and sometimes throughout the process of the Senate, they are also committed to doing other things while the Senate is sitting and can't be in 10 places at once. So all in all, I think the committee process is one that must be valued. It must be one that people take the blinkers off and look at objectively and say, well, this is a way in which we can enhance the system. And if senators looked at that process seriously from time to time as to how can we improve the Senate inquiry system or the scrutiny of the legislation, then I'm sure that there are ways in which that can be achieved. There is no doubt at all that there is an intention from all senators to get the best out of legislation, but sometimes the Senate is so focused on getting legislation through on a timetable that some of the things are not considered probably as much in detail as they could otherwise be. And this process enables that scrutiny to take place. So I would dearly like to see a system similar to that that was designed way back then reintroduced to give people a different opportunity to look at legislation. And it's not one that makes a Senate committee travel all around the country. It is not that type of inquiry. And if we look at the classic example, I think, was the reference of the GST bills to Senate committees, that ended up just a complete and utter circus, because all committees had their own little section and off they went all around Australia and listening to the most outrageous at times, outrageous submissions. But once again, that is part of people's right to express their opinions to the Senate, but it was not necessarily designed originally. The process was not originally designed to take that type of inquiry on an Australia-wide tour. So I do hope that it gives an opportunity for senators in the future to look at options in the way in which Senate committees can work effectively, efficiently, and contribute more time back into the Senate chamber in a constructive way, as opposed to just consuming time going around and around in what can usefully be done in a committee environment.
Thank you, Auckland. And thank you to Rosemary and the committee office for inviting me to this. I must say I'm a major fan of the Senate, always have been. I remember I said when I left the Senate I couldn't understand why anyone in their right mind would want to go into the House of Reps. Now, what was wrong with all those people? Unfortunately, there were a couple of people from the House of Reps who had come around to listen to valedictories, so they were a little unimpressed, but I still maintain that view. And I'm a big, big fan of the Senate committee system as well. I was asked by David to have a look at the Senate committees and legislation from a minor party point of view. And I did have quite a bit to do with that while I was in the Senate from 1990 to 2002. But I should tell you that from 2002 till now, I've had very little activity, and I haven't really kept up with any of the minutiae of what's been changing within the Senate. So I may well be well out of date, but I can only tell you what's happened from my own experience. First of all, I have been on many committees, many committees. As a Democrat, as someone from a minor party, and I can see Dee is here, Dee Margetts is here, she'll agree with me on this. It's remarkable how many committees you do have to get onto. There's not that many of you to go around, and if you want to be a part of legislation, then you're just going to have to do that. I always found that I could only handle two portfolios reasonably. How anybody, you know, as when it was only Dee and Christabel in the Greens in the Senate, how they could handle everything, I have absolutely no idea. But I'm sure she'll be interesting about that when the time comes. As far as I was always concerned, there were three basic types of bills. There were the very, very simple ones, and these are the ones that we used to do on Thursday lunchtime. We may still, yep. And they were the ones like changing levies. It had happened every year. Everybody would agree on it. And in fact, I can only think of one instance where a bill was put on at Thursday lunchtime that I thought deserved a little more scrutiny. That was the bill to when East Timor became independent, and we had to change our agreement on the East Timor Sea, on the gas fields in there. And that came up on a Thursday lunchtime. I didn't complain at the time, but I did remember the first time that bill came around to put the agreement in place. And it was not one of the first set of bills of being non-controversial. It was not one of my second set of bills. It was one of my third set of bills that sort of made your hair stand on fire and fireworks went off everywhere when somebody mentioned it. It was a bill that was incredibly controversial. However, by the time we got to the second time around, everybody just got up and did 5 minutes Thursday lunchtime, except me, I have to say. They were all saying, yes, this is perfectly reasonable. I got up and said, I think we've all forgotten what happened in the first place with this. And you were all telling me how silly I was and this would never happen. Oh, guess what? It has. And here we are changing it now. So that's the first type of bill. The second type are more complex, usually. And I think these are the ones that Sue was talking about. They're the types that they have some amendments or some controversial aspect to them that people may want to talk about, people will want to talk about, but they're not hugely important basic changes to legislation. And that's the third type that that you come across. The one set of inquiries I can think of on the third type of bill, the really basic changes, was we had two inquiries, Senate inquiries, into the legislation to change the broadcasting legislation to go over to digital, to bring in pay TV. They were huge. They were absolutely enormous. They couldn't possibly have been handled in a very minor way. They had to be handled in a very big way. And I think the one thing that came out of my being in those two committees was that it is such a technical area. It is such a complex area. The jargon that John was talking about earlier, John Hogg was talking, it's something I've never heard of before in my life. It was something you really had to get used to, and you really had to have experts telling you, you know, starting from scratch, you know, here I am in kindergarten on broadcasting and digitisation. Tell me what it's all about. And if I hadn't had all the committee... if I hadn't had all the submissions to the committees, those two committees, and hadn't been able to question all those witnesses, and we did have witnesses, we had them from all over the world, witnesses coming in on that, there is no way on the face of this earth I would have been able to handle those bills as I did. And I'm sure that's exactly the same for everybody else who was handling them in the chamber. It's not just the Democrats there. That would have been all the parties. They were immensely useful committees to have into immensely, what turned out to be immensely complex bills that nobody got right. Well, the government didn't get right. I should say, I'm sure I got most of it right, but there you go. And it is the one time, I think it was the pay TV bill, it's the one time anybody has got up, it was a minister, and he got up in the chamber and he said, well, I'd just like to say I should have listened to Senator Bourne when she brought this amendment up. I thought, thank you. And it was true, he should have, and all the rest of them. But I think that they hold a very, very important place, although I take what Sue says too, that it can be very frustrating, or it could be when I was in the Senate, that the where we had meant to do all the committee stage of a bill on that Friday, all you got really was an extra committee stage, because you'd get back to the Senate and we did another committee stage. The amendments had been written, but they'd usually been written by that Friday anyway. And it was just sort of two discussions, one with people from outside the Senate, one inside the Senate. Now, there is a lot of, I think there's a lot of value to that anyway, because you get that democratisation of legislation where anybody who is interested can come and tell you, although that three-day reference was very difficult for anybody who was interested and wasn't in Canberra. It may be, I don't know how the Senate committee system is working now, but it may be that it is worthwhile just having another look at it and seeing if it can be better suited by some small changes that could go on. The other thing that I wanted to talk about from a minor party point of view was the changes of 1994 when we changed the Senate committee system. Now, I was asked on a radio program after I left in 2002 what was the thing I was most proud of in the Senate, and I said the 1994 changes to the Senate committee system. And much as I would like to tell everybody they were all my own idea, they weren't, sadly. There was a lot of discussion. There was a lot of unease. That's probably not the right word, but many people in the Senate were thinking by that stage, we've got a House here that has so much more input than you've got in the House of Reps, where there were two main parties and some independents. We had a couple of other smaller parties, and we had Senator Harradine as the independent. And there was, we did have a very useful and a very comprehensive Senate system at that stage. But one of the main things that used to frustrate me hugely, I know it frustrated Christabel and Dee as well, and it certainly frustrated Senator Harradine, was that if you were a Democrat, then you probably had one person on a committee that was looking into anything. But if you weren't, then you were very lucky to get onto any committee at all. You were very lucky to have any input at all. So the change that we made to that, to the rule, as far as that goes, is that we brought in participating members. And that meant that any senator, not just the ones who couldn't be on the other committees, but any senator from any party who had a particular interest in a bill could, or any other inquiry, could nominate themselves as being a participating member on that inquiry. And they would have all the rights of the normal members of that inquiry, of the ones who would have been there before, but as well as, except for, of course, technical aspects, like when will we meet next and when will we finish this off. But it didn't really matter, because you were able to put in a dissenting report, you got all the submissions, you were able to ask questions of witnesses, so you had pretty well all the rights of the ordinary members of that committee. Now, that system of participating members, I noted, even when other things were changed, that never changed. That has been the case from 94 until now. I hope it never changes. I think it's one of the best things we've done. The other two changes we had, I remember having a discussion with Senator Hill at the time about this and others, was that we had a Senate that had about equal numbers of government and opposition senators, and then on top of that it had the Democrats, and I can't remember how many there were of us at the time, eight I think. There were Greens, there was Senator Harradine. And it seemed to us that we weren't the House of Representatives, and it was only reasonable that half the chairs of committees would be government and half would be opposition, and that half of the ones that had government chairs would have government majorities, the ones that had opposition chairs would have opposition majorities. I put forward a motion to the Procedure Committee, which was accepted, and then we formed a subcommittee of the Procedure Committee, and this had really reasonable may not be the term people most think of for Senator Faulkner and Senator Ray, but as far as I was concerned, they were very, very reasonable on that subcommittee, and they were prepared to talk about anything. They were prepared to consider everything. So there was Senator Ray, Senator Faulkner, Senator Reid, who was the president at the time, I think, Senator Kemp, and myself. And we had really reasonable discussions. We came up with a set of amendments for coordinated committees. Estimates would be put in with legislative committees, and the general purpose committees would stand by themselves. I wanted to have, purely thinking from a completely independent point of view, I wanted to have half of the general purpose committees and half of the legislative committees to have opposition chairs. In fact, Senator Ray talked me over on that one. He was very concerned about anybody, about oppositions manipulating legislative committees, and particular estimates. And he was in government at the time. The Labor Party was in government. But it was the end of 1994, and we knew the election would be fairly soon. The general consensus at the time was that Labor was not going to get back, but you never know. So it looked like everybody had something to win after the next election. Whether you were in government or opposition, you'd have half the chairs. Whether you were in government or opposition, you'd had half the majorities. And no matter who you were in the Senate, you'd be able to nominate yourself for a place on a committee. We talked it all through. Senator Ray eventually convinced the rest of us that his point of view was very reasonable, and I still think it actually was, that you should have legislative committees with government chairs and general purpose with opposition chairs. That remained in place until the government took over the numbers in the Senate, which I think was 2005. Yeah, and then it changed, and it went back to virtually what it had been before 94, except participating members were still there, but the chairs all went back to where they had been. But then I'm very pleased to say in 08, I think, when it changed back again, the system changed back to virtually the 94 system. I still think it's a much better system. It gives us the ability for the government to look after the legislative side and non-government, and it wasn't all just the opposition party, it was all opposition parties, to look after the general purpose side. I think it was a real breakthrough for the Senate, and it made the Senate into a much more democratic institution, but also a much more inclusive institution, where if you didn't belong to Labor or Liberal, then there wasn't really a problem with you being able to be on a committee. I can see I'm just about finished, but I'll just make one more point. I, as a Democrat senator, had a terrible time getting information out to the voters. If the press didn't want your your views to get out. They didn't get out. Unless people were listening to the Parliament, which an astonishing number of people actually did at the time, and an astonishing number of people listened to Senate Question Time when it came on at midnight or 1 a.m. or something. I could not believe. And I went to the... Sorry, this is an aside, but I went to the Philippines once and there were clubs of people who got together and watched on the international television Senate Question Time. They couldn't care less about Reps Question Time, but there was a Bronwyn Bishop cheer group, there was a Gareth Evans cheer group, the rest of us were sort of by the by, but they'd get together and they'd yell and scream at each other when one of these two made a point. It was the most bizarre thing. But sorry, that's beside the point. But unless you were actually one of those people who watched the Senate, then you really, unless the media was interested, you didn't know anything about what the Democrats were doing. I could put out press releases, we could advertise, but we couldn't afford it. We could have public meetings and 15 people would work out what we were on about. But one of the main things that we could do was be really effective on a committee. If you were the chair of a committee, of course, you were the one who was asked about what the committee was up to now. If you were just on a committee, especially for the big inquiries, many of the inquiries were covered by the media, the big ones, and your point of view would get out there. I found it myself one of the best ways to let the voters know what I was doing, where I was going, what was happening. And I think I'd be surprised if it wasn't the same for the Greens now. I think that the Senate committee system is something that is really worthwhile evolving constantly. I don't want to see any of my changes changed again, so don't change any of them. They're brilliant and will last until the end of time. But everything else is open. And I think that we should all be looking at where things can get better. I would love to see a new evolution of where the Senate committee system goes, just to make it better. I've got to agree with the other speakers who said we don't want it too much bigger, because it's very hard for everybody to cope. But I think that with the 8 paired committees, which I assume we still have, yeah, and the... we always thought 3 or 4 select committees was what we could cope with. I think that we have a committee system that is well and truly the envy of many parts of the world and something that we can be really proud of. Thank you.
Question? Yes. Thank you.
You know, in the last sitting week, before the dissolution, prior to the election, the Legislative Council of Victoria voted to establish a standing committee system based wholly and solely on that of the Senate, and unashamedly so. In fact, our new standing orders look remarkably similar to those of the Senate. I did warn the Standing Orders Committee against plagiarism, but they didn't seem to care. One of the challenges, I think our biggest challenge in getting the new system up and running will be the legislation committees, which, like the Senate committees, will be chaired by the government. And I say that because in this parliament we trialled a standalone legislation committee, but it was rarely used, principally because the two sides of the House had different views about how it should be used. For example, the opposition saw it as the opportunity to have a wide-ranging inquiry into a bill, whereas the government saw it principally as a substitute for Committee of the Whole. In fact, they took the view that if we had a bill referred to a legislation committee, then it shouldn't go to Committee of the Whole at all. So I guess we're very fortunate to have 40 years of Senate committee experience to draw on, hence this conference is very timely, and there are a number of us up here. I suppose what I'd like to ask both the presenters is, in relation to making our legislation committee system work, you know, what do we need to do? For example, should there be minimum or maximum times for inquiries? Should there be parameters for the inquiries? should the government modify its legislative program so that it brings in bills earlier in order to have them introduced at the time they would otherwise have wanted to? What should we, based on your experiences, what are the what sorts of things that we should do?
I think that's a really key question. I think it's one that the Senate is still looking at. You've got a problem in that, which I'm sure you're aware of, in that the whatever you bring in, the government of the day, if they've got the numbers, or whoever has the numbers, can override it. And that has happened in the Senate several times I can think of. But if you have a convention that, the way we started off, as Sue was saying, the way we started off, we looked, well, I personally looked at three types of bills. So there was the one you didn't need to refer. There were the middling ones, where there was one complex area or a couple of complex areas or a couple of controversial areas. And then there are the really big earth-shattering ones. You will probably end up with earth-shattering ones having a big committee inquiry anyway, and going around all over the place getting lots and lots of people. There will be many people interested. There will be many experts who can give you lots of good info. It's those middling ones that you've got to watch because, as Sue said, they can blow out of all proportion, particularly if you have an interest group who really want to either stop the bill or change it to their advantage. If we ever had a bill to do with family law and it went to a committee, you would know that you would just have the most huge influx of submissions. The first one we had, I remember, all the submissions said exactly the same thing in exactly the same wording on exactly the same paper with a different signature. And, of course, they didn't all go out to you because that was just silly. So they'd say, they'd give you one, and then you'd get, instead of another 400 the next day, they'd say 400 more of A. And that kept going and made no impression on us whatsoever. And then there were, they thought better of that and said, say in your own words something like this. Most people just wrote whatever it was that was something like this. But what it can do is then they'll ask to speak, and what it can do is it can really take a huge amount of time. It's incredibly stressful. It's incredibly time-consuming for the staff, unbelievably time-consuming for the staff. And they're ones that you'll know what they are, of course, but you've really got to watch them, those ones. In my opinion, you don't need a long time for those. It's very difficult not to put up a long time. You'll get into trouble for doing it from the people who want you to, but they're always in a minority with that sort of thing. You do have a problem, though, with bills that are do have some complexities, do have some controversy in them, and you have differing points of view from differing experts. You're going to have to leave more time for that sort of thing. I really think, though, that this is one area. If you get it right, I hope the Senate looks at what you do, because I think it is one area where the Senate can, very valuably to the Senate itself, have another look at that, have a look at what sorts of bills need what sort of time, how far should you go. You remember when we first brought in those Friday sittings for committees, mainly the idea was not that you would get people from around the country, but that they would be on the low level of the medium bills, and that all you really needed was people who were in Canberra anyway. You'd need the public servants, you'd need the minister to come and talk, you'd have all the parties in the room, and if there was anybody else around in Canberra who had a view on it, then they could come and speak. And they've just blown out of all proportion. Sorry, I'm taking too much time, Sue.
Well, I think that one of the main things that you'd need to consider really is that making sure that you have a time frame established by the Chamber. Mm. It's as simple as that in many respects. So that the Chamber then decides what's the reporting date, and then the committee has to work within that. And as long as that's established in a reasonable, bipartisan fashion, then it generally works all right. And okay, if the bill does tend to attract more attention, then they can always go back to the Chamber and seek an extension of time for reporting. But
I mean, what Vicky was saying in terms of governments can always override it, I just say that they do that at their own risk. Mm. Just listen to what Robert Ray was saying earlier on, you know, there's payback. Mm. And so if a government decides that, no, we're not going to have an inquiry on this, then watch this space, because this will take an eternity in the chamber. So it's better to have that communication going, and also making sure that there's a priority given to the length of time that the bills need proper scrutiny. I don't know whether or not it would be necessary for them to actually do anything other than making sure that there's enough communication between all parties within the chamber to make it work. And if that communication is established right from the beginning, it's better than trying to patch it up as it all unravels.
Next question. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks, everybody. I was interested in what you were saying about the necessity to work out how legislation can and should be looked at in committees, and I'll be talking about that in some of my presentation, but I thought I'd give you an interesting example. Having been an upper house member in the Senate and also an upper house member in the state in Western Australia, one of the things that was really interesting is that state agreement acts in Western Australia were major acts giving government support to major corporations, which potentially shouldn't have been accepted under competition policy. But there was an agreement within the Legislative Council that there should have been a proper assessment of the public interest of how those agreements were put together. But nearly every time such agreements were put together, it took, in the last minute when they finally made the agreements between the industry and the government, then they told us it was so quick they had to just shove it through. So there was virtually no means by which we actually had the ability to properly assess public interest. And to me, there were some serious problems there. So it's going to be a really interesting process to work out how better to do that from legislative levels.
That must have reminded you of Christmas in the Senate, where many bills came up for debate over 2 days or something.
To give you no time to look at them properly. Yeah.
And that comes back to our previous question, I think, in terms of scheduling the legislative process, to make sure that it is a reasonable legislative process and not one that just can't be achieved without this cramming and, you know, many a time I drove home from here at 7 o'clock in the morning and turned around after a shower and change and came back again. And that's just ridiculous. People can't operate under that system.
One last question. We have time for one last question.
I would like to introduce the word culture. And the culture I'm thinking of is our Australian narrative. And what did I put down? The word democracy, and against the word democracy, I put Switzerland with its 26 cantons. I thought of Italy that came out of a disaster, and if you had 4%, you got a voice. It's still running about 59 years later. So my overall thing is I've felt boxed in because you're talking about a Senate group that don't represent the rest of Australia. When are you going to get actually Australia to say, I've been in that parliament, I've had my 6 months, I've made my contribution. All you're talking about is an old, out-of-dated system that they're trying to get rid of in England. And let me finish off with this one so that you have something to think about. The Scots have a nationalist party. The Welsh have a nationalist party. And the last election, there's apparently an English nationalist party coming. When is Australia going to represent Australians with an electoral system that represents our culture?
Will you join me in thanking our panel members for their contribution and the interest, the lively from